You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Although the Second City isn't doing in-person shows, classes, or events, we're doing all of those things virtually. Head over to secondcity.com and you can sign up for a class. We've got really affordable drop-in classes where you might be improvising with people from other countries. We're doing corporate workshops and events. And we have a whole new slate of virtual shows that you can get tickets to. Get more comedy in your life by going to secondcity.com. Welcome to the world of Tony Ho from CBC Podcasts. It's an award-winning, bite-sized narrative comedy series about human relationships, familiar, hilarious, and sometimes unnerving. The troupe features Miguel Rivas, Adam Niebergall, and alumnus of the Second City mainstage, Roger Bainbridge. They will take you on a darkly comedic ride that finds honesty in every situation. You can listen and subscribe to Tony Ho on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
I just got done talking to Pamela Fuller, who is Franklin Covey's Chief Thought Leader on Inclusion and Bias and one of the firm's top global sales leaders. She actually began her career in nonprofit fundraising and advocacy. After earning her MBA, Pamela served as Diversity Analyst at the U.S. Department of Defense. This book is really good, and she has co-authors Mark Murphy and Ann Chow. The book is called The Leader's Guide to Unconscious Bias, How to Reframe Bias, Cultivate Connection, and Create High-Performing Teams. Enjoy the conversation.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Pamela Fuller, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Kelly. I'm thrilled to be here.
Pre-pandemic times, I was part of a team working with a health institution, and they were exploring unconscious bias among medical professionals. In one of our early meetings, one of the physicians was surprised when I suggested that bias is neither good nor bad in and of itself, but that left unchecked, it can have good or bad consequences. And he was adamant that bias is always bad. You actually talk about this in the book, that bias is, I think you say, to be human is to have bias, right?
Absolutely. So bias is a natural part of the human condition, right? In any given moment, we are faced with 11 million bits of information and can only actively process 40 of them. So our brain is a supercomputer, but it has a capacity problem. And bias exists in the form of cognitive shortcuts to help us navigate the world. If we didn't have these shortcuts in our brain, I mean, we literally could not complete our sentences because there would be just too much input. It'd be overwhelming. So it is a function of to sort of help us organize the world. And I think what he was probably adamant about was that some of the consequences of our biases, right, the impacts of our biases can be very problematic and limiting as we examine them.
Yeah, you write in the book, quote, "The sense that people who have biases are inherently ill-intentioned or morally flawed is one of the paradigms that stops us from making progress on this issue." And I have this conversation a lot with my partner in crime formerly at the University of Chicago, Heather Caruso, that in our work, we're really trying to get people to understand that they treat people differently. And as you said, that has consequences. And with that as a starting point, I think there's room for lots of conversation. But the problem is it tends to start in other places and people get scared off.
Yeah, I mean, if we're in this defensive posture, we're just defending, right? You had mentioned in our, as we were setting up for this, Dolly Chugg, and she talks about this, that our definition of ourselves as good people stops us from actually becoming better people, because we're so stuck in this paradigm that we need to defend our goodness, that we can't possibly be bad, right? And you hear people say, but I'm so well-intentioned. And the challenge with that is, like, I have two boys, right? They're 4 and 11, and they make a mistake, or they're fighting, or somebody gets hurt, because an 11-year-old is a lot bigger than a 4-year-old. And the first thing out of their mouth is, but I didn't mean to, right? And the fact that you didn't mean to doesn't actually negate the consequence. Your brother is injured, right? And so I think it's important for us to separate our intent and the actual consequences.
And I love it. Dolly also talks about the fact that if we thought about this stuff like tech, where we are constantly getting upgrades because we get more information and things improve. So if we can think about that, like, you know, to think about 10 years ago, I didn't have the literacy that I have today, and very few people did. And that's, and you know, 10 years from now, it's going to be very different. So, like, we could actually cut ourselves a break to do the work, I think.
Yeah. I mean, 6 months ago, people didn't have the literacy that they have today, right? There's been this accelerated volume of progress as we think about diversity, equity, and inclusion, and the impact of our biases on society and systems and organizations. And I think that sense of continuous improvement is really important here, that we can continuously get better, and that that's a gift. That's good, right?
Yep. Okay, I want to take you through and have you respond to some of the data that you point out in the book that sort of supports how ridiculous some of these biases are. Strong regional accents. So people have strong regional accents. What consequence could they face in the workplace?
So there's data that says people with strong regional accents, depending on their accent, there's a correlation between accents and sort of how they're identified as capable or intelligent. And so it can hurt them in the course of their career or in an interview, right? Particularly as we think about first impressions. If people have strong, you know, a strong Boston accent, a strong Southern accent, anything particularly rural, can really hurt them over time.
How about the lighter or darkness of your skin?
I think this is really interesting, because it's not, you know, the current conversation in society is around Black people, right? Or BIPOC, all, you know, Black, Indigenous, and people of color. But even within communities of color, there are challenges with colorism, and that light-skinned people of color are more likely to get promoted and more likely to be compensated more and more likely to get a job offer, right, after an interview than darker-skinned people of color. And again, like, the question becomes, same with accent, is there any correlation between these parts of our identity and our ability to do the job?
No. And the worst one is CEOs and height.
Right. If you've read your Malcolm Gladwell, 58% of CEOs of Fortune 500 companies are over 6 feet tall, and only 14.5% of the male population in the U.S. is over 6 feet tall. And so you think about races and ethnicities that are more have smaller stature, and of course women, right? What percentage of women are over 6 feet tall? I learned recently that globally only 10% of the population is over 6 feet tall, but it is how our brain signals power, right? And authority, and who gets to be in charge and run something as big and important as a Fortune 500 company.
I've seen other data points that in general, tall people make more money over the course of their career as well. I mean, it's
tall people and beautiful people. So there's, right from the beginning, even just babies. I mean, so we would argue all the babies are beautiful, right? For the record, all the babies are beautiful. But some babies, if they have that sort of cherubic look, right? Like the puffy cheeks and sort of, and red rosy cheeks and sort of chunky, that they are actually spoken to three times as much as the sort of non-cute babies, in quotes. And so right from the beginning, we have this beauty bias, and it aggregates over time because that turns into language development, right? It can actually impact capability over time in that sense.
I'd also suggest it impacts this idea that you talk about in the book, which is connection, right? One of the most basic human needs is this idea of connecting. And if you have this advantage from the beginning where people are teaching you to be a super connector, right? I mean, it's funny, my 23-year-old son just went through his third job interview for like a real office job, and he got it. And you know, his mom and I have worked in theater our entire lives, and we have books everywhere. We are storytellers and talkers, and you know, and I never doubted he was going to get this, because he can go into a room and he is eager to look to connect. But other people don't have those kinds of advantages, and they weren't brought up in these households. And so this is a thing about this book that surprised me in all sorts of good ways, because I think during these times, right, the pandemic and the fight for social justice and all of it going on, you have a couple different choices. And for some of us, it's like, how can I look inside and be better and do better? And also, how do I self-care to do that during this time? And there's a lot of that in the book. And you start at self-awareness, which is, I think, kind of lovely. And you define it in the book as, quote, the intellectual pursuit of introspection. So talk to us a bit about the importance of self-awareness kind of in the starting point of this journey.
Yeah, I think that if we think about bias through the lens of impact, the goal is to be able to understand the impact. And so the first step in that is building our sense of self-awareness so that we can even recognize when we may have a preference in a circumstance or situation. So you started with data and you look at the data, and no one is fundamentally surprised by that data, right? If I said people who are taller claim more authority and have more success in the CEO role, or more like likelihood to get in that CEO role. Or if I say people with Southern accents are deemed less intelligent than people with like a Midwestern accent, right? No one is shocked by that. We hear it and we say, oh yeah, that's right. But then when it comes to our own evaluation, we are not necessarily, it doesn't feel as intuitive. And so I think self-awareness is one of these words where everyone says they're self-aware, and then you talk to them for a little bit and you're like, I don't know that you understand what that means. I mean, self-awareness is really being connected to your visceral responses as you're engaging with different people. And it is a level of sort of elevated consciousness, right? Awareness of, you know, when you feel defensive, when you feel joyful, when you are literally physically leaning into a conversation versus sitting back or crossing your arms or furrowing your eyebrows, right? That these are ways in which your body is reacting to whatever is happening. And there is preference that is driving that, right? There's bias that is driving that. And so that's heavy work. I think we dismiss that, right? Or we assume that we all have it, and we don't. It takes real time and energy to sort of build that and do that self-examination. The other thing that we talk about in that same vein is this connection between our identities and the biases that we hold. And it's a little bit therapeutic in nature, right? But there's essentially an origin to each of our responses, right? I do have two boys, and I think of the world in terms of superheroes, right? And so superheroes all have origin stories. And I think our biases and our preferences have origin stories, right? We lean into someone who reminds us of someone else who we are fond of. And we lean away from someone who may have put us in danger in a previous experience, right? And that is part of this sort of heavy lift of introspection.
Yeah, I mean, someone once explained some of that to me of like the person who's running that stop sign, it's because they're an asshole. And when I run the stop sign, it's because I have an emergency and the way we see the world. And your co-author, Mark, talked about one of his biases, which is education, which is definitely one of mine. I was like, oh, yeah, no. I place this kind of odd value that in turn becomes a judgment. And you even told a story on yourself, which is shocking, given what you champion, right? That you discovered you had this bias when you had a candidate who came in.
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to education, I was really raised with this belief that education and having education from good schools, sort of brand name schools, is really important. And I have an undergraduate degree and an MBA from private liberal arts schools, right? Yeah. And I clearly value that. And it was really this conversation with my husband that was really interesting, because if you ask me the thing that I value most in my team and who I'm hiring, it's work ethic. Like, I just feel so strongly about that. I think it's probably born from my first generation background and the way in which I saw my parents work hard and what they bred in me in terms of working hard. But then he asked me the question, well, what is the correlation between work ethic and going to a fancy school? And he said, when I look at resumes, I think the person who worked full-time and went to school part-time or took 6 years to get a degree because they had a child or they had family care or they just couldn't afford it and paid for it credit by credit, that is work ethic. Yeah. Not the person who necessarily sort of got into a school and didn't have to worry about how it would be paid for either through scholarships or privilege, right? Not to say that those of us in that circumstance didn't work hard, but if the thing I'm looking for is work ethic and that sort of grittiness, right? Mm-hmm. Why am I associating that with privilege, right? And the benefit of going to a fancy school. And that sort of slapped me in the face, but it was such a good point. And I think we have these rules through which we identify potential and talent. And it is often reflective of our own experience. And so having even someone to talk to who can poke some holes in that, right? Or being willing to poke holes in that and look at it differently can be really powerful.
You also talk in the book about, you know, we are many identities. We are not one identity. And we get so frustrated when people just, you know, focus in on the one identity. We actually created this exercise to speak to this called I Am Somebody Who. And so we have all the participants are in a circle. And they're instructed that when the facilitator says something that is true for them, they move to another place in the circle. So it's I'm somebody who's wearing jeans. You know, I am somebody who believes in gun rights. I am somebody who is a vegan. And you get you're shocked because you're like, the vegan is a gun owner. It was, you know, like and it's such a odd reflection of it's and we do it. Well, the first exercise is to just set that starting point of kind of that we are abundant as humans.
Mm. We do something similar, actually, and I just love how it pushes connection, right? So this sense of curiosity that we all have, because if you're in that room while the facilitator is asking these questions, you have an assumption about who's going to step forward for which question. And when people don't step forward in the way that you may have predicted, mm-hmm. it breeds in you additional curiosity. And this sort of art of connection that we have natural empathy towards some people because we feel akin to them or we feel affinity. And then when in the absence of that, if we ask critical questions and sort of lean into that sense of inquiry, that connection, that empathy starts to build, right? And that's what I love about activities like that, is that we assume that we'll step forward for this and someone else will step forward for that. And it's never what we thought, ever, right?
Yep. I also think that the movement part of our embodying the action actually makes a difference. I think we mm-hmm. forget that we're also living with our bodies, and that can be very powerful, especially when you're connecting with different people. I want to talk about some of the bias traps that you talk about in the book. This has come up a few times in completely different contexts, but all related to our faulty maps. Like, we've been working with terrible maps and you have a map of Africa in the book, and inside that map, you see the United States of America, you see China, India, the UK, France, Germany, Italy, more. And that is not the way that we were brought up and continue to be. I don't see the maps changing in schools.
No, they're not. I mean, the perspective with which we look at the maps has like North America as dominant, right? And has the US as dominant and as the largest thing. And it's actually quite small compared to Africa, right? Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie she has a TED talk called The Danger of a Single Story. Mm. And I find it so powerful that we have these narratives, right? And things like maps or things, how we talk, the language we use to talk about sort of the United States dominance in the world, I think reinforce these single stories. And the example she uses, one of the examples she uses is Haiti, that we always describe Haiti as the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. And this is the identity we give it. And we never define Haiti as the first free African republic or the first free Black republic in the Western Hemisphere, right? Haiti is the place where Toussaint Louverture overthrew the slave masters and was independent and founded an independent Black country in the Western Hemisphere. And that narrative, right, that story is so empowering, whereas the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere is so limiting. And so I think maps and these other sort of identities and personalities we give places and things can be really, can either be limiting of possibilities or enhancing of possibilities and potential. And it's important to think about it through that lens.
I think one of the things that I've learned the most in the last couple of years is this idea of putting yourself at the center of the story. And how, especially white men in this country constantly putting themselves in the center of the story. I was actually on a call with a colleague yesterday, and he was going through, he's an older white male, going through inspirational quotes for this program we're putting together. And he realized after he's done that they were all by white men. And he was like, I don't know that 6 months ago I would have thought of that. And I was a little ashamed, and then I did the work, and I'm like, yeah, that's actually this is good. This is good stuff. This is us sort of moving forward and exposing. My wife did this like 3 years ago, where she just decided she was going to take a year and not read any white male authors and mostly authors of color or LGBTQ plus, and found an incredibly enriching period of time of discovery for her. And these are just stories and books.
I think it's really interesting, you know, in our first round of, in writing a book, you of course get feedback, right, on initial drafts.
And so we,
for better or worse, but for always for better, right? But you have to sort of gird your loins, right? Because it could be, it feels personal. But we did, you know, several rounds of feedback. And one of the pieces of feedback we got initially was that, and it was predominantly from sort of middle-aged white men, right? Was that it was, I was too self-effacing. So I told too many stories and examples that were about me, and they couldn't see themselves reflected in that. It just felt like far away. And it was really interesting because when you get feedback, your instinct is, well, let me adjust to the feedback so that it's a good book. But I think if we think about that feedback through the lens of what you just shared, so much of that for them was this inability to connect because they were not in the center of the story.
Yeah.
And I really pushed back on our team. I said, I don't think this is something we need to change, right? Like what brings a book, particularly a nonfiction book, to life is stories and examples.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm not a neuroscientist, right? I'm someone who has expertise in learning and development and behavior change. And one of the ways that we do that, as you know, through your work is stories and connecting. Mm-hmm. And so instead, I think it was important, and we have we've sort of adjusted some of the forward and the introduction to address this fact and try to push people a little bit that you don't have to see yourself reflected in something for it to be relevant. And I think that the idea that we can sort of take advice from women, from marginalized groups, from the queer community, that we could learn from those experiences is in itself part of that heavy lift of introspection, right? Being able to read a story where you don't see yourself reflected and recognize that that is what you're feeling, that's pulling you away, and then pushing yourself to lean into that and think about what you could take from it that's positive, I think is really important.
And there's data to support that. I mean, the marriage laws as related to Will and Grace being on the air, you know, inviting these stories into your living room, all the data around, you know, someone who's different than you moves in next door and you build a relationship and it changes things. And it's actually rather simple. It's not, I think people are making it more difficult than it has to be. Interesting note, I did a draft outline for my next book. And my agent was like, "Hey, this material's all great. Where's your story? Where are you?" And so I was like, "Oh, okay. I think that is the important thing. If people are going to connect to the person, and yes, there's data points and other things that can go along with it. But that's why I thought was an interesting thing in this particular book because you have three voices who are all sort of speaking and they're all different, but they all have a slightly different tone, but you feel like an ensemble that you're all bringing your sort of strengths together and weaknesses to sort of explore this territory in a very rich way. And I want to talk a bit about, you talk about embracing mindfulness. And I don't know that someone who's picking up a book on unconscious bias is going to expect the authors to talk about mindfulness.
But I think, I mean, it's sort of like the foundation of a house, right? You would never design the second floor before you've designed the foundation, right? And you need this sturdy foundation. I think mindfulness was a And what we heard in our feedback, frankly, was from DEI practitioners was that it was a meaningful contribution to this space that they wanted to see more of. Mm-hmm. That in order for us to build self-awareness and really hijack bias when it has problematic consequences, we need to build this muscle of mindfulness. And I think there's a couple ways in which it connects. So there is there's data around the higher up you get in an organization, the more sort of formal power you have, the less empathy you have.
Yeah.
And building mindfulness as a practice grows your ability to be empathic, right? Because you are less concerned about what you are saying and more concerned or able to see what is happening around you, right? It is essentially sharpening the saw around observation and your ability to notice how someone is reacting to what you're saying or what is pushing you sort of viscerally in a direction. And it's also, as we think about the bias traps, so for those who haven't read the book, we talk about in the book these three bias traps. These are circumstances in which we're more susceptible to lean into bias thinking. And the first is when we are overwhelmed, when we feel overloaded with information, we throw out information that's useful. The second is feelings over facts. When we have high emotion about a circumstance, our brain takes how we feel and turns it into a fact, right? So someone says, is Pamela capable? And the response is, I don't really like Pamela. It's like, well, that wasn't the question, right? But that's what happens in our brain. And the third is need for speed, that when we feel under duress or we need to act quickly, we make decisions that are self-serving, right? In our own interest, because we are panicked, basically. And if you think about the three of these bias traps or circumstances, the way to get around all of them is to create space between stimulus and response, right? That we are experiencing something and we have to create some space before we make actual decisions and take action. Action to be able to hijack this problematic biases that can come up. And the way that we create space is through mindfulness, right? It's actually slowing down and breathing and thinking critically about what's happening. So I think it's such an important leadership skill. And it often gets dismissed the way that people dismissed vulnerability before Brené Brown.
Yeah, right.
Right. It's like a soft thing. And who can sit around and meditate for 2 hours? And, you know, that while if you can meditate for 2 hours, that's admirable. And I think amazing. Right. That's not what we're saying you need to learn how to do. It's really in the small moments. It's short moments to create some space and sort of hijack those shortcuts.
Yeah, I had this conversation with my therapist a few weeks ago where I was like, I've never been able, my wife has a mindfulness practice. I've never been able to meditate. And, you know, she's like, yeah, you don't have to be on a mountain. You love music, right? And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, sit for 10 minutes, breathing, listening to a piece of music. Try to do that once a day or maybe twice a day. And I was like, oh, this is a fantastic little timeout for me. And it was funny because I did interview an author recently who actually talks about moments of tiny reflection throughout a day are probably what's better for us because it's more available to us. Mm-hmm. And so it's a similar idea. You also talk in this section about pausing and describing. And it reminded me of this exercise that we've developed that we've been able to do virtually where we have someone pick an object that holds special meaning to them. And then we ask them to describe it without any emotional connection, just what it is. And then we have them describe it with the meaning it has and like see the difference, right? Mm-hmm. It's a very sort of powerful way of pausing and describing and seeing the back and forth. So talk to us a bit about what you mean that in the context of the book.
So if you think about, you know, a circumstance in which you find yourself, you were in a meeting or like virtually, right? We're in these meetings. So you're looking at someone else in the Zoom box. And if you pause either in the moment or after the meeting and try to describe everything about that meeting, right? Or everything about that interaction. Everything from facial expressions to what the person had on to what environmentally was around or even environmentally what was happening to you, right? It is this sort of heightened awareness of detail. And in doing that consistently, you're essentially building the muscle of self-awareness because then it becomes sort of second nature for you to think about your interactions and moments through this lens, you know, and then you start to notice when someone does pull back or when they, or when you lean in, right? Or when you have a negative judgment. Something similar, sort of another lens, even to overlay that with, is then thinking about a circumstance through sort of a T-chart of facts and feelings. And if you describe everything you know, in quotes, about a situation, but then had to divide it into fact and feeling, we often find that a lot of what we quote unquote know is actually how we feel. And we need to seek out additional facts to validate or invalidate that.
Something that I learned late in my career that I wish I had known earlier in my career. I've been in the Second City for over 30 years, and I got in a leadership position very young. And I was always the person, like, that if we were interviewing someone for a full-time position, I was always often the last interview to decide cultural fit. Because I understood the culture, and I was young, and I was hip, and this is Second City and all this stuff. And now, if I'm on a panel and someone says, like, give me one piece of advice, I say never hire for cultural fit. It is because you're going to hire people who look like you. And the funny thing is, artistically, we knew this. Like, when you put together a Second City cast, like, you put together a athletic team, right? You're not going to have all, like, first baseman or whatever. You know, I'm looking for, like, no, I want a writer, and I want someone who maybe an ingenue, and I want, like, so I knew about that inherently in terms of the art that we did, but never understood till much later that really we err greatly by hiring for cultural fit.
Yeah, I mean, organizations are really good at creating leaders and teams in their own image. And so in that sense, like, when you talk about, I mean, this is why it's important to talk about the distinctions between diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, right? Because there are organizations who might be more diverse, appear to be diverse. Yeah. But in reality, because all of that hiring has happened for cultural fit, and we've promoted people who fit better, in terms of how they operate, it's all very similar in terms of how they make decisions or look to solve problems or engage with other people. So we can sometimes, like, hammer out whatever advantage we get from diversity through really leaning into fit. Fit is a bit of a four-letter word in this space, right? Because there's so much baggage in fit. Like, what do you mean fit, right? And I think even that line of questioning can be really helpful. Like, people, leaders often in my work bring up fit. They're like, well, fit is really important. I mean, they need to fit here. And I'm like, okay, but what do you mean? And it's sort of that, like, six whys, that if you keep asking what fit is, you get to things that might actually be in contradiction with what the organization is trying to build. Like, you're like, well, they just didn't, it doesn't seem like they would have a lot of conflict. And it's like, okay, but one of your tenants is disruptive innovation. So those things are in, that's in conflict. You're looking for people who aren't going to make waves, but you want to innovate, right? That doesn't make a lot of sense.
There's this recent MIT study that I saw on, because I was thinking about this issue with someone who was highly critical of our organization in these various meetings. And I've been thinking about this idea of, like, you know, we want people who are going to challenge us. But also it's hard sometimes, especially if the person's walking into the room hot. And this MIT study actually showed that in sort of these psychologically safe environments, when you know that someone's got your best interests, that this sort of, like, you know, challenging is very effective. But the reverse happens. If this person doesn't have your back or is trying to win, the whole group loses. And I thought it was a very interesting distinction of, like, oh, I can see how that works. Because you actually write in the book about formalizing the role of devil's advocate, which I think is great. And I think it's a way to challenge this of, like, no, understand that you're doing this, like, with love. that's what this is about, right? And if you do that, I think people will hear and can act.
It also, I mean, we all know that we go into meetings and it's like, Pamela, you have a meeting today with Kelly. And it's like, oh. Right. There's always this person. There's always a person who you're just like, you have to brace yourself because you know that it's going to be full of conflict or full of critique. And it's hard. It's hard on us to hear that and to work through it and to know what to do about it. And so the idea of formalizing the devil's advocate, sort of active dissenter, it also gets, you can rotate that role so that somebody doesn't become like they're always the person. Right. Okay. And it pushes.
Yeah. That'd be terrible.
It's terrible, right? It's not good for you professionally, and it's not good for team dynamics. But rotating that role also pushes people who might be more compliance oriented to think about things differently. Like if your job today is actually to poke holes in this, then that sort of, that makes us better and you're rewarded for that. Then it can also push people who might be more compliance oriented to think a little bit more critically about what's happening.
So we always ask our guest for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, when groups of people are making something out of nothing, they don't get very far by saying no, and they don't really get very far by saying yes. We ask them to say yes and, to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. Do you have a yes and story for us?
Sure. So I've actually done some work with improvisationalists.
Okay. Improvisers.
Oh, that's an easier word. My bias is for big words, as I think you probably read in my book.
Yes, totally.
But I think that all of my work, I think the work that led to the publishing of this book was yes and, because I actually, my job, the job I'm hired to do at Franklin Covey and the thing that I'm mostly compensated on is actually a sales role. So I'm a client partner on our public sector team, and I deploy all of our solutions and lead strategy for a book of business. And then I felt really strongly that if we are experts in leadership and development, or learning and development and in leadership, we were missing this lens, right? Because lots of leaders think of themselves or sort of fancy themselves great leaders, but fewer leaders think of themselves as inclusive leaders. And if you don't add this lens to your leadership, then your leadership can't be great, right? Because people are being even unintentionally left out of it or left behind. So I felt really strongly about that. And there, I sort of leaned into building a solution, a content solution, and then a book, and like, I could have said no to all of that, right? I brought it up as a challenge, and the response was like, we don't have anyone focused on that right now. And structurally, we're not in a position to have anyone focused on it. And I could have just left it there because it wasn't what I was compensated to do. And so I said, yes, and, right? Yes, I'm going to do it. And I'm going to do it in a way that I feel like is really authentic to me and to our firm and our perspective on leadership. So I've just kept saying yes to everything that comes up around bias and DEI for our firm internally and externally, and it's led to this book.
It's a terrific book. It's called The Leader's Guide to Unconscious Bias, How to Reframe Bias, Cultivate Connection, and Create High-Performing Teams. Pamela Fuller, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Kelly.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survives.
Survive.